The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Smith, Judge Ross, Judge Rodenberg, the Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We're here for our second oral argument of the day, which is A20-1460, Allstate Indemnity Company Appellant versus Constantine Starchuk, MD et al. Respondents. I'm going to repeat what I understand the split of time to be today. So first of all, I understand Mr. Peters will be arguing for the appellant. And then for respondents, I understand that respondents intend to split their time. Ms. Heiser, is that how you pronounce your name?
Yes, correct, Your Honor.
Great. Ms. Heiser, I understand that you will take the first 10 minutes, is that right, for respondents?
Correct.
Okay, and you're representing Dr. Starchuk, is that right?
And Twin Cities Pain Management.
And Twin Cities Pain Management, okay, so you'll have the first 10 minutes. Then I understand David Asp will have 2.5 minutes on behalf of Mr. Bartner, is that right?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, and then the last 2.5 minutes will be Mr. Elsass on behalf of Mr. Soto, is that right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Great. All right. Well, I think with that background, I think we're ready to go. Appellant, you have 15 minutes. Appellant's counsel, you have 15 minutes for your principal argument, 5 minutes for rebuttal. The respondents will argue as we just described. Each of you, when you start your argument, please state your name and the party you represent for the record. And I believe we are ready for appellant's counsel. Go ahead, please.
Good morning. My name is Luke Peters. I'm here representing Appellant Allstate Indemnity Company. Appellant's been represented by Simple & Associates PLC in these proceedings. This is the law firm of Attorney Rick Stemple. I recently left the firm to accept employment elsewhere, but agreed to return to do argument today. Out of the way.
Mr. Peters, if you don't mind just speaking up just a little bit, yes. I've turned my volume up, but you still seem a bit faint.
I'm trying to keep myself in frame. I'm working with a short desk and the microphones. There we go. Okay. There are a number of orders being appealed here, and a number of important legal issues are presented, but at bottom, this is a simple case, and it asks a simple question. Was Allstate's seeming misunderstanding of a district court order effectively a waiver of the right to conduct discovery, and was it a $200,000 error? Of course, appellant posits that it was not, and that this harsh result evinces abuse of discretion by the district court at multiple stages of the proceedings. To begin, the reason we have why this litigation was initiated in the first instance is that Allstate has a legal duty as a no-fault insurer to conduct reasonable investigations of claims of or no-fault medical benefits. The litigation here grew out of that legal duty. Second point, as a matter of state policy, there's a preference in favor of resolving cases on the merits rather than on procedural grounds. In this case, we didn't reach the merits.
What do you mean? The district court reached the merits and decided summary judgment. Am I misunderstanding the record?
So what happened was the parties, back in September 2019, jointly moved to stay the scheduling order. And there's written correspondence confirming the agreement. The parties articulated their reasons for seeking a stay of the scheduling order. In particular, they wanted to forestall discovery expenses. The court ruled the court neither granted nor denied the motion, at least explicitly. What the court said was the parties may move any of the dates of the scheduling order except the following. Now, as it turns out, in practice, none of the dates could be moved, even the discovery or the discovery deadline, which was the main concern of the motion. And that's because of its relation to the dispositive motions deadline.
But counsel, may I just interrupt? The mistake that you think, that you say that Allstate made was what? Thinking that the dispositive motion deadline could be extended? I mean, it was clear that the dispositive motion deadline was not extendable by the agreement of the parties, was it not?
Allstate was operating under the belief that the parties had agreed to stay discovery. They jointly moved to stay the scheduling order, and the court ratified that agreement.
I'm not talking about discovery, though. I'm asking whether there was a mistake on a part of Allstate in believing. Did Allstate believe that the dispositive motion deadline had been extended?
No, and that's not, the order doesn't show that the dispositive motions deadline could be moved by the parties.
So I understand that civil litigants prefer to do all their discovery before dispositive motions. It makes sense to do so.
Oh, the problem.
Nevertheless, even if the even if there had been a belief that discovery deadline was extended, but the dispositive motion deadline was not, shouldn't Allstate simply have pursued discovery in order to get what it needed in order to defend against a dispositive motion deadline or motion that they could anticipate would be happening by deadline?
Well, I think what happened is that in September of 2019, the salience of the dispositive motions deadline being kept in place by the district court wasn't fully comprehended by our paralegal, who was the one who read the order and notified Allstate at that time. And so it really only became an issue later.
I don't understand. Can you rephrase what you just said in terms that I can understand? What exactly are you saying when the paralegals didn't appreciate the salient effect of the, what do you mean? And I assume, I'm assuming that we're not talking about a paralegal, but a lawyer who's responsible for the case.
As a practical matter, it would have been the paralegal who directly reviewed the judge's order in September 2019. But what I meant was that this deadline didn't pose a problem or didn't appear to pose a problem at the time, because it wasn't clear that the district court would take until February 18, 2020 to resolve the pending motions to dismiss. And again, operating under the belief that there had been a stay of discovery.
I don't understand the reasonableness of that belief.
If you go to Doc 105, Exhibit 1, this is written correspondence between counsel for the parties, and it shows that the parties agreed to a stay of discovery pending motions to dismiss. I think there was later some argument about whether the stay was merely contingent on the court granting the joint motion to stay the scheduling order in full or not. But I can tell you that as interpreted by our employee, it was the court's ruling was seen as a stay or a ratification of the party's stay.
Well, let's leave aside how your employee interpreted it and explain to me why a lawyer who was responsible for the case would interpret it that way. I mean, isn't that the standard that we're looking at? Not whether the lawyer delegated the responsibility to somebody who might not comprehend the significance of not moving a dispositive motion deadline. Help me to understand why a lawyer would be confused.
Our counsel believed there was a stay based on the agreement of the parties, and that's we have writings to that effect. And again, that's later been disputed as to the nature of that agreement.
Right, but the district court said provided a deadline for dispositive motions. So regardless of the parties agreeing that some internal interim deadline might be moved around, the district court was pretty clear that there's a certain deadline that would not be moved, one of those being, I think, the trial date and the other being dispositive motions.
Yes, but it also was not clear in September 2019 that we wouldn't get a ruling on the motions to dismiss until 24 days before the discovery deadline.
If that's the case, I mean, at some point, as it got closer to the deadline, wouldn't it be the burden of whichever party felt it needed discovery for dispositive motions to go to the other side and say, we're gonna end this stay? We have to pursue discovery, whether you believe there was a stay or not. I don't understand this.
The judge's order from September 2019 says that the parties are able to move the discovery deadline. It just it wasn't immediately comprehended that there was a contingency where if the parties agreed to stay discovery and the maximum amount of time was taken by the district court to resolve the motions to dismiss, that it could result in an extremely abbreviated period for discovery.
Let me ask another question. By the time you get to February 20th, it's my understanding that the defendants either all file or all of them file around that same period of time, dispositive motions, motions for summary judgment, correct? Mm-hmm. And I recall two of them declarations, in other words, affidavits by the defendants saying what your allegations in the complaint are not true, that it's a management contract. Here's a copy of the contract. I don't have it all in front of me right now, but saying there's no fact issue about the ownership of the clinic, right?
We didn't have the opportunity to depose the defendants, and we didn't have the opportunity to depose anyone.
Just a minute. Is that correct? I mean, did they produce affidavits which, on their face at least, and with their attachments, suggested that there was no issue of material fact regarding ownership of the clinic?
They supported their motions for summary judgment with affidavits. That's correct, Your Honor.
Right. And then did you respond to that with any affidavit that you claim raised a genuine issue of material fact on that question?
We opposed the motions for summary judgment on procedural grounds, but we also indicated in our brief that there were issues of material fact that...
Were those produced in affidavit form?
No, they were not, Your Honor. And,
so if you're the district judge and you've got affidavits from one side that say, here's the ownership relationship in concerning this clinic, and they include documents that support their position on that, and the other side just says, we want to do some more digging, because although the discovery deadline has now expired and we're at the dispositive motion deadline, and produces nothing from these supposed confidential informants or anyone else raising a genuine issue of material fact, seems like the district judge had no choice but to grant the motion.
We've said consistently in these proceedings that the business filings for Twin Cities Pain Management as to ownership should not be dispositive, that they're based on the exhibits that we included with our complaint, that there's more to the story and that we need to conduct discovery to gather all the facts, and that defendants, respondents are in possession of those facts.
Well, but what you could have at that point submitted an affidavit, could you not, that would have attached those documents or those materials that you now argue raised a genuine issue of material fact in response to the dispositive motion?
We've conceded that in opposing summary judgment, should have included an affidavit form. However, we've also said that we've substantially met the affidavit requirement of Rule 56 within the brief itself and within other contemporaneous filings. I'm thinking of the March motion to amend the scheduling order to extend discovery. And we submit that we've met our burden in that regard.
Was Allstate prohibited from noticing the depositions of the affiants immediately?
No, Your Honor, but as a practical matter, 24 days was insufficient to conduct discovery. And it really wasn't 24 days. And I'll tell you why.
Well, let me pause you for a minute. You say conduct discovery. My question is, I'm just asking about a deposition. You have affidavits from individuals that you recognize would end the case for your client if the court accepted as true their statements. What prevented Allstate from immediately noticing their depositions upon receiving the affidavits?
I don't recall the exact date that we received the affidavits in support of their motions for summary judgment. I'm thinking it was probably 2 weeks out from the discovery deadline. I can tell you internally, we're a small firm and the paralegal who handled litigation coincidentally left the firm on February 24th, 2020. And I was on vacation until February 27th, 2020. It's just
why is that the defendant's problem? I just don't understand how it is that your client wouldn't pursue at least a deposition. I more significantly, I don't understand what prevented a deposition request immediately.
Are you saying, Your Honor, immediately from the after the resolution of the
motions? Well, frankly, at any time that it should have become apparent that the dispositive motion deadline was looming and that the trial date would not be changed by the court. But aside from all that, at the very least, once your client got affidavits indicating factual issues, I don't understand why an immediate notice for the taking of a deposition to challenge those statements in the affidavit, if there's a basis for challenge. I assume your lawsuit is based on the idea that there's a reasonable basis to challenge their statements in the affidavits.
Well, Your Honor, I would just reiterate that we had a pending motion to amend the scheduling order. We've argued that there was good cause to amend the scheduling order and that given the, you know, extremely abbreviated period remaining for discovery, noticing the deposition may have been a futile effort. And that may explain why we elected not to notice depositions.
Well, not noticing a deposition is certainly a futile effort, but I don't understand why noticing a deposition would be futile in light of the fact, it seems like you're hanging your seems like the plaintiff's hanging hope on the idea that the court was going to grant a motion that wouldn't necessarily have been granted. I mean, there's no guarantee the court's going to grant your motion.
We felt that it was necessary to have additional time to conduct meaningful discovery, and we felt that we didn't have sufficient time. I think that's a reasonable statement to make, that 3 weeks is not enough time to conduct discovery. And again, we were operating under the belief that that there was a stay of discovery, and given that the motion to dismiss was ultimately not resolved until just a few weeks before the discovery deadline, we felt that there was good cause to amend the scheduling order.
Thank you, counsel. And you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Ms. Heiser.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Alethea Heiser on behalf of Dr. Starchuk and Twin Cities Pain Management, his clinic. I may also refer to it as TCPM today. The district court was well within its discretion when it both granted summary judgment and sanctions on behalf of defendants in this case. The record shows that Allstate filed a complaint with very serious allegations in it, allegations that it contended were supported by evidence and witness testimony. Allstate used those claims as a basis to deny payments to their insureds for years. Allstate admittedly didn't engage in a lot of investigation and discovery, but contrary to the representation here, they did engage in some discovery prior to when the orders on the motion to dismiss issued.
Counsel, may I interrupt you just for a moment, apropos of what we were just talking about with respect to the dispositive motion? I'm reading one of the briefs. I don't know if these are the right dates or not, but I understand the discovery deadline was it March 13th? Is that right?
Correct. Yes.
And it appears that the motion for summary judgment was filed, at least by Respondent Soto, maybe by all of them, on February 28th?
Correct.
Okay, so 28th, so like 15 days before the end of discovery, right?
Yes.
And then it appears that the appellant's motion to amend the scheduling order wasn't immediately upon receipt of the motion for summary judgment. It was actually toward the end, maybe just the day before discovery ended on March 12th. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay, so the motions for summary judgment is served February 28th. There's no notice of deposition of any of the affiants that were whose affidavits are submitted in connection with that motion, and then a motion to just amend the scheduling order happens to a day before the, or is noticed a day before the deadline. Is that right?
That's all correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
And I'll even back that timeline up. We served discovery on February 12th. Allstate served counter discovery on February 13th. So both of those things occurred before the order on the motion to dismiss was issued. Our notice of summary judgment was filed on February 19th. So by that date, they knew we were, you know, certainly by February 12th and also by February 19th, they knew we were acting in compliance and in accordance with the court scheduling order.
And I assume that the discovery served by appellant was just for written discovery, interrogatories or documents or something?
Yep, exactly. And we responded and did produce documents on schedule in response to those discovery requests. So there was some discovery that took place, but the fact of the matter is the case got to a point where it was time for Allstate to come forward and provide to us and to the court some evidence to support the allegations it had put in its complaint. And it simply didn't do so. I don't know whether it couldn't or whether it refused to, but the evidence never showed up.
Well, you're talking about the merits of summary judgment. Let me, the district court, seemed to be pretty candid in at least one or two of its orders, accepting some responsibility for the awkwardness of the procedure. Can you address what Judge Burke was referring to there when he took some blame for the problem with discovery?
I think, frankly, Judge Burke was being gracious. There was, you know, Allstate had come forward. They claimed to have an honest mistake. I don't really understand the reasonableness of that. Judge Burke's order was very clear. We obviously had an obligation to move for summary judgment by a certain date. He was explicit that that wasn't going to move. So I think he was attempting, he really gave Allstate every opportunity throughout this case to show up, to get an extension on their discovery responses when they required it, when they filed to amend the scheduling order. He prompted them to supplement their record to make it a more fulsome record. He bent over backwards to make sure that he was reaching a decision that was appropriate and fair in this case. And at the end of the day, the record supported the decision he reached.
Can you address the timing of the scheduling and amended scheduling order in light of the lack of all of the appearances by the named defendants in the amended complaint?
At the time, so we had received a scheduling order from Judge Burke. Included in that order was a requirement that if the trial date was going to be moved, a motion had to be brought very immediately. I think it was within 10 days. At that time, Defendant Soto had not yet appeared. So we, along with Mr. Bartner's counsel and Allstate, put together a stipulation and proposed to move to stay the scheduling order and the discovery. Obviously, the court did not grant that request and instead issued an order that set very clear deadlines that would have to be met in the case. And Mr. Soto's counsel appeared thereafter, and we all act in accordance with the court's orders. I want to go to the court's sanctions order here and the fact that we aren't just talking about Allstate's failure to produce evidence in response to summary judgment. We are talking about their failure to produce evidence that even supports these allegations in the complaint, which are significant. They're significant allegations. They were denying these claims of the insureds based on a claim of corporate practice of medicine. This is a common law doctrine. It basically means that clinics and hospitals should be run by individuals with medical licenses. And it's a doctrine that's been pursued almost exclusively in Minnesota by insurance companies. And opposing counsel has been a very active participant in those types of cases. We've pointed the court to one case previously, the MSCI v. Midway massage case, in which the opposing counsel representing a different insurance company brought a very similar case, a case that lacked a substantial basis, a case in which they sort of tried some fishing expedition type discovery, but overall just delayed dealing with it, lost the case, and sanctions were awarded, which this court upheld. It's a case with a lot of similarities in some ways to the facts we've dealt with here. One of the differences, though, is the seriousness of Allstate's allegations in this case. You know, they allege that the clinic is a facade for essentially criminal activities. And they didn't make that allegation based on information and belief. They claim to have evidence to support it. If we go to Rule 11, they have an obligation to come forward, to have a basis for that, right? Rule 11, 02C says that attorneys must have an evidentiary basis for their pleadings. If they're going to plead based on information and belief, they must specifically say so. If we look at the amended complaint or the second amended complaint, Allstate did not plead these allegations based on information and belief. Allstate pled them supposedly based on evidence. Once we got into the case, we asked for that evidence. Allstate had an obligation to produce it. Judge Burke told them in the order on the motion to dismiss, they would have an obligation to produce it. But they didn't. They didn't produce it in response to discovery. They didn't produce it in summary judgment. And that's what led to our sanctions motion. We came to the court and said, listen, they've made these allegations. Our client's had this cloud hanging over his head. And yet here we are at this point in the case. And even that bare minimum, there's just nothing in the record, not a single piece of evidence to support these allegations. And that's the record that was before the district court when it decided to grant sanctions. And it really can't be disputed that Allstate failed to put any evidence in that would meet their obligations under 1103C. And so the court's decision to grant sanctions was also absolutely not an abuse of discretion.
Can you speak to the argument that, the award seems to be tied to attorney's fees, and yet a large part of that was unsuccessful motions to dismiss because the complaint did state a claim. Why should that be part of the sanctions? And what's the factual finding that makes that makes that amount relevant and appropriate, I guess, for sanctions in this case?
Yeah, absolutely. Judge Burke, this argument was made below, and Judge Burke did address it. And what he explained was that, you know, the motion to dismiss stage, you know, the pleadings have to be taken as true. That's just the procedural posture at that point. There's no ability to look behind them and confirm whether or not they were actually based on any real evidence or brought in good faith. So what happened is we then got into the case. We had a chance to ask Allstate to come forward. Allstate had repeated opportunities to come forward and provide some evidence that there was a basis here, and they couldn't. If
right,
the court
but,
had known that at the Rule 12 stage,
right,
I think they would have been.
Hold on. As to sanctions, though, the idea, I mean, shouldn't the sanctions be based upon reasonable litigation? And if it's clear, as it was from Judge Burke's decision on the motions to dismiss, that there was enough in the pleadings, why would, if there's enough to survive a motion to dismiss in the pleadings, why would a plaintiff be responsible for fees generated in order to bring the motion to dismiss? How is it frivolous at that point? I mean, the allegations, I mean, it's one thing, I get what you're saying as to bringing the claim itself. And I'm trying to get a sense of why this part of the calculation of fees should be, is justified as to the motion to dismiss.
Because it appears they were bad faith allegations. Allstate can't come forward and substantiate them. If they had pled based on the evidence and information they had, certainly what's attached to their amended complaint doesn't support, for example, these allegations about criminal activity, about a facade. I mean, these are very significant allegations.
Let me put it a different way. Why should the plaintiff be responsible to cover as reasonable fees to bring a motion that lacked sufficient support in the law? The motion being the motion to dismiss based upon the pleadings.
Because Rule 11 is about making sure that parties are honest with the court. If these statements had been made outside of court, we would have other actionable options. But because they were made in court, we are limited to the remedies in the rules. And what Rule 11 says is that they have to have a basis. They did not. We incurred a whole lot of expenses.
No, I'm
defending our client against allegations that were made in bad faith.
I'm granting the idea that I'm not challenging the reasonableness. My question is not challenging the reasonableness of a decision to issue sanctions. I'm talking about incorporating into the quantity of the sanctions the fees that were the amount to cover motions that were not legally supportable at the time the motion was brought, which is the motion to dismiss. The pleadings were sufficient.
I'm going to make 2 points, and hopefully I'm not just restating things. I am trying to get to your point and answer it. What I think, had the complaint been pled based on what Allstate had a good faith basis to believe, it's likely our motions to dismiss would have succeeded. They included allegations about confidential informants and other information that they could not in good faith plead, apparently. And we were forced, therefore, we not only lost the motion to dismiss on that basis, but were forced to go through litigation in order to clear that up. I would also, though, second, like to make the point that when you look at the case law and sanctions, it is not just about remedying our harm. It is about deterrence. And here we've got Allstate, a sophisticated and large corporation, engaging in a course of conduct that was, you know, inappropriate and not consistent with the court's rules. And for a company of its size, these sanctions are still a drop in the bucket. And so I think from a deterrence perspective, the sanctions are also justifiable. I know that my time has run out. I'm happy to answer any more questions, but I also just want to be respectful of my co-counsel.
All right, it looks like our questions are done. Thank you, counsel. Mr. App, you have 2.5 minutes. Or excuse me, Mr. Asp.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. David Asp, represent Patrick Bartner in this matter. Mr. Bartner owns PMB Management Company, which provides non-medical services for healthcare providers. I'd like to take a shot at answering the last question and following up on what Ms. Heiser said here. And there really is a deterrent impact here that's discussed in Judge Burke's sanctions order. And you have to understand, for someone in Mr. Bartner's situation, for example, the allegations here are extremely damaging to his professional reputation. If your job is to manage medical practices, which is of course a highly regulated industry, allegations that you have, quote, acted in secret and created shell corporations to hide efforts to create a network of cross-referring clinics that prey on no-fault insurers is extremely serious and damaging to your professional reputation, just the assertion of it. And so what Judge Burke said is, when he denied the motions to dismiss, he said, I'm skeptical that you will ultimately be able to prove these, but because you have obligations under Rule 11, I accept these allegations as true, and you survive the motion. As a consequence of that, we asked in discovery, what's the evidence here? What's the evidence that Mr. Bartner did these things? And in discovery, in response to interrogatories, the answer was that Mr. Bartner had a prior history of being involved in clinic operations in Minnesota. Nothing to show a secret network of cross-referring clinics, as alleged. Then at summary judgment, when Allstate had an obligation to produce evidence, it came and said that Mr. Bartner had been sued previously for being involved in kickback schemes. And there was an entity that Mr. Bartner was involved with that had been sued previously. That was almost a decade ago. And importantly to him, he vigorously denied those allegations, opposed them, and the case was resolved with no finding of wrongdoing and no admission. So,
thank you, counsel. It appears that your tiny little amount of time has expired.
But I made my point about the deterrent effect, and with that, I'll finish. So I apologize for going over.
No worries. Thank you. Mr. Elsass, you have 2.5 minutes also.
Thank you. May it please the court. Doug Elsass for respondent, Mr. Soto. I want to make initially the point that the sanctions motion really, an order really has almost nothing to do with the what Allstate contends is their reasonably mistaken impression as to scheduling orders and amending scheduling orders. It stems entirely from the fundamental problem that it turned out, as far as we can tell from the record, there's no evidence to support these very specific and serious allegations, including against my client. And Mr. Soto's involvement really kind of highlights why the Rule 11 sanctions are appropriate. There was hardly anything in the complaint about him, scant allegations, and similar to Mr. Bartner, some of it related to allegations about other associations that have nothing to do with the claims in this case. So from the very start of this, and our firm, we can't even take any credit for it. Mr. Soto was pro se, and he said he put in his own motion to dismiss before we were retained and said in it, and Judge Burke appropriately cites this in the sanctions order, there's no basis for this. There's no evidence, there's no allegation. So back in September, he put Allstate on notice of this. And it turned out, as far as we can tell, there was no evidentiary support. I think to answer the court's question about the appropriate measure of sanctions and basis for it, it's that once there's a violation of 1103 in this case, then the rule says 1103B, payment to the movement of some or all of the reasonable attorney's fees and other expenses incurred as a direct result of the violation. The violation here was the initial pleading that, as far as we can tell, was not supported or substantiated. So then it follows that all foreseeable consequences of the bad faith litigation, including reasonable motions to dismiss and other such conduct, that is an appropriate measure of damages. So there was no abuse of discretion by the district court in following Rule 11. So with that, unless there are questions, I'll stick within my time.
Perfectly done. Thank you. 5 minutes for rebuttal for appellant's counsel, Mr. Peters.
Yes. The first point I would make is that I don't know how you have a violation of Rule 1102C without a reasonable opportunity to conduct discovery. I know it's in contention as to the status of the stay of discovery, but appellant has offered a very clear explanation of what happened in this case and why.
Well, let me pause you for a minute there. I think the district court was looking for a basis in fact to support as reasonable the allegations in the complaint. So I don't think you need discovery in order to establish for the district court that the allegations were reasonably made. Why would you need discovery for that?
Your Honor, we've supported the allegations in the pleadings with exhibits, and much of the information that was necessary to oppose summary judgment was solely in the possession of respondents. And we said as much in our opposition.
I think part of the problem there for the district court is that you claim to have confidential informants who knew something. That's in the hands of Allstate. I understand why the explanation that was given for why that was not reduced to affidavit form on a summary judgment defense, but that's information that Allstate claimed to have and yet did not introduce in an admissible form to defend against summary judgment.
Yes, and Allstate took the position that the confidential informants' identities would be disclosed were meaningful discovery to occur, and unfortunately that did not occur.
What about in response to sanctions? What would prevent Allstate from providing whatever evidence is available to Allstate in order to avoid the sanctions?
Well, Your Honor, by the time the sanctions came into the picture, summary judgment had been taken under advisement at least a month prior. That was one thing. The second part was that the district court never ordered the disclosure of the confidential informant's identities. The third point is that the respondents never brought a motion to compel the disclosure of the confidential informant's identities, presumably because summary judgment had already been taken under advisement prior to the due date for appellant's discovery responses.
I guess I still don't understand what prevented your client from opposing the sanctions, potential sanctions, using the evidence that you say was in your client's hands.
If we were to have done that, Your Honor, we would have been producing additional evidence after summary judgment had already been taken under advisement, and as of June 22nd, I believe, summary judgment had actually already been granted. The sanctions were not awarded for another approximately 90 days. What I can say is when the district court belatedly held a hearing on the issue of the confidential informants in late August, I was authorized to disclose the names of the confidential informants at that hearing if asked or ordered, but I wasn't asked or ordered.
I'm having a hard time articulating for myself, which means I don't understand the answer to the question. What prevented Allstate from providing evidence in opposition to sanctions? Evidence that was in Allstate's hands that would have supported as reasonable the claims that Allstate made in its amended complaint.
For example, affidavits from the persons who you were then authorized to reveal their identity.
Right. Okay. The issue here was that we were seeking to avoid disclosing the identities of the informants and protecting their safety. So we were seeking to avoid an unnecessary disclosure, and we felt that the that the best way to oppose summary judgment was on procedural grounds, which is to say, we felt that summary judgment would be denied if the motion to amend the scheduling order to extend discovery were to be granted. And so for that reason, we elected to defer disclosure of the identities of the confidential informants.
If I understand you, you're saying it was nothing prohibited you, but your choice not to, for practical reasons that you've just articulated.
We were seeking to avoid an unnecessary disclosure that would potentially put the informants at in a risk of danger.
Danger. I see your time has expired, but if I could ask one more, just a follow-up to that.
Of course.
Judgment. What do you mean danger?
We were concerned about their safety.
No, I understand what danger means. I know. What do you mean by that?
It's not in controversy that the allegations in this complaint are
I'm going to spare you and withdraw the question.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Peters, thank you. Counsel, thank you all for your arguments. The case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in a statutory time period.